Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later, a new approach to vaccines and a menu of ways we can enjoy our food better using just sounds, textures, and different kinds of utensils. But first, until recently, the typical day for Mars rover Curiosity went something like this. Power up, travel to a new location, sample the chemical makeup of the surrounding terrain. But before it could call on its laser to blast a piece of rock to test it, it had to wait for nearly 48 minutes, which is the time it takes for NASA to receive a signal from the rover and then send back its instructions. Pretty tedious. But since May 2016, NASA has been testing an autonomous system on Curiosity, letting the rover decide which rocks to sample and what data to send back to Earth. Which raises the question, if you can make Curiosity even smarter and able to make its own decisions, does it need NASA's hand-holding anymore? Well, that's a question we're going to ask my next guest, Raymond Francis, engineer at NASA JPL, and he led the team that deployed Aegis. That's the name of the new AI system to Mars. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hey there. So tell us, what does this new AI software allow Curiosity to do?
So Aegis allows two different things: autonomous refinement of pointing errors when people on the ground are trying to point at a very fine target, and sometimes there are challenges in hitting it accurately with ChemCam's remote laser spectrometer, and also autonomous target selection, where the rover chooses for itself, without ground in the loop at all, rocks to measure with ChemCam.
Can it make its own decision which rock to zap with its laser before asking back at HQ?
That's exactly what it does, yeah. And so, given certain parameters from the science team and authority to go do so, the rover can drive into a new place, pick the rock that best matches what the science team asked for, and immediately zap it with the LIBS system.
So that must save an awful amount of time, because I would imagine most of the time is just sitting there waiting for those instructions.
Yeah, and in fact, to get around the constant waiting, we actually typically upload a whole day's worth of activities at once. But that still means that after it drives into a new terrain in the afternoon, there's still plenty of daylight and time for science, but Earth hasn't seen it yet. And that's when Aegis really shines.
So is it in operation now? What's happening now? Is it permanent?
Yeah, we uploaded it at the end of 2015, installed it, checked it out over the following winter. And then in May of 2016, we gave this software system as a tool to the mission science team to use as they saw fit, and they've been using it regularly for over a year now.
So how does it know? Give me a little bit of inside baseball on the AI. How does it work? What does it know that it is an interesting rock, for example?
So it starts with a computer vision system. It takes a photograph, usually with the stereo navigation cameras aboard the rover, and then it can process the image and look for interesting geological features. The way it does that is it starts with an edge finder that looks for sharp changes in contrast. And then it tries to find groups of those edges that it can enclose into a loop. And when you have a closable contour like that, or a nearly closable contour, you've probably found a distinct object. And in a scene on Mars, that's probably a rock. So the next step is to look at... Yeah, there's not much else.
Unless it's looking at itself, right?
That's right. And in fact, it's very important that it not pick targets on the rover, that it picked the rocks, both for science and for safety.
I'll bet that laser's pretty strong.
It is, yeah. We can put 2 gigawatts per square centimeter into the target, and that's enough to vaporize rock. We certainly wouldn't want to do that on the rover itself.
Yeah, yeah.
But keep going. Tell us what it does.
Yeah, so of course, you know, it finds those closable contours. It finds the then the next step is to look at the groups of pixels that are inside each contour, what we would call a target, and look at the properties of those. Are they bright? Are they dark? Are they smooth and consistent, or is it a modeled inconsistent texture? Are they large? Are they close? Are they far? What's the shape? All of those features are things that you can derive relatively simply from the image once you've identified the targets. And then we encode geological interestingness as an algebraic linear combination of those pixel properties. So some combination of bright and dark and small and far away, these things can be used to recognize different types of geological materials.
So how good, how smart has it been at picking out the right thing to zap?
It's actually been performing very well, I think even better than we had hoped. One of the things the science team asked us to focus on was to look preferentially for pieces of rock outcrop, like bedrock that's still in the place where it formed after the drives. And in the area we're in, we managed to find a set of computer vision settings which allow it to do that with well over 90% reliability. Mm. Most of the time, it picks the most desired target material, and when it doesn't, it picks something that's almost as good.
Now, there's curiosity. It must be pretty old in terms of when it was first on the drawing board, right?
The rover launched in the rover launched in 2011, and it's been in design for years before that.
So I would imagine the hardware on there is not as robust as our iPhones or something like that.
Yeah, so it's robust in the sense that it's hardened against radiation, but it's not powerful like the fancy processors you have in your desktops or your cell phones these days. The flight computer that we use runs at 133 megahertz.
Wow.
And we have access to 16 megabytes of RAM. So this is your best desktop computer of 1993 or so, or your cell phone of 2002.
Wow, that's amazing. So I would imagine then you cannot upgrade the intelligence of the Curiosity much more because you don't have the onboard hardware and software to make it really smart.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of surprising that we can do what we do already. And in fact, we had to make some compromises in terms of performance at finding geological features versus performance in terms of speed. One of the things, for example, is the stereo computation is because we have to find the distance to all these targets to mm-hmm. correctly focus the laser. And that stereo computation is very expensive. And we learned to slim it down to run as fast as possible.
And I find it amazing that you can do all of this with the rocks and it doesn't even have color eyes.
That's right. Yeah, the nav cams are black and white grayscale cameras.
Do you have plans then? I guess there's not enough room on this to make it fully autonomous to drive on its own.
Do you mean like autonomous navigation?
Yeah.
Because that is actually
yeah.
something that we do have.
Yeah.
Yeah, the rover is able to autonomously navigate over short distances.
And how do you make it better? I know everybody's thinking about the Mars 2020 mission. And that stuff must be on the drawing board. Can you give us some ideas of the parameters of that device?
Yeah, so in the next mission, we will have a marginally better computer.
Just marginally?
But not great. It's not a leap ahead from the same thing. It's hard with space computers because everything depends on the computer.
Right.
And that computer has to work in challenging environments, and no one wants to be the first to have their multi-billion-dollar mission rely on a new unproven computer. So we have something that's just a little bit better, but it isn't a generation newer. But we do have new algorithms in development, and at least the current version will certainly be able to run in 2020, and we'll have color nav cams.
Mm-hmm. So your grand visions for improving AI performance, be just refining what you're doing now, doing it better.
So I think, yeah, so we have some new ideas about how to find targets. I described that edge and loop strategy. We have some new ideas for what we might do there. And with color, we will have more information to work with. But also, I think there's other avenues. For example, allowing the rover to reschedule activities to better fit in these kinds of autonomous science targets and better manage its resources on board to to help the team on Earth simplify their planning. I think these are where we're going next, I think.
The crucial question for you, do we have a name yet for this new rover?
For the new rover? No, but stay tuned, because I think NASA will be looking for ways to choose that name in the not-too-distant future.
Now, we can help you out with that here, Science Friday.
Oh, do you have some ideas?
Get you a name. We could, you know, we have 2 million listeners. We can come up with a few names, I'm sure.
And you know what? Maybe that's an approach.
and so you're very happy then with how about the health of it? Is Curiosity in good shape? I know the other rovers are sort of, they're old and they're showing their age.
They are. And of course, it's a difficult environment to be in. You would show your age too if you've been wandering around in that terrain for 5 years. MSL, the Curiosity rover, is by and large working really well. And the instruments are pretty healthy. There's been some attention to the wear on the wheels, but they're actually holding up pretty well as we've learned to better use them in our terrain. So, yeah, I think we're pretty confident that the rover will keep going for some time yet.
And give us an exact position where it is on Mars now.
So we're inside Gale Crater, the same place we landed. That crater is 150-ish kilometers across, so we're never going to leave. We're going to do all of our mission inside that crater. We drove across the more or less flat plain of the crater floor towards the mound in the middle. And that mound is like 4.5 kilometers high. It's quite a mountain, really. And we're now exploring the lowest layers of that mountain, looking into the sedimentary rocks that describe the history of this environment. And we're actually coming up on an area that we had identified from orbit as containing interesting minerals that probably formed in a wet environment. And so we're just approaching this place. And expect more interesting results as we see this, what may be a transition in the environmental history of rock formation in this environment.
You mean because of the wetness of the area?
Yeah, yeah. We see from orbit this ridge of material that appears to contain minerals like hematite. And so this is different from the terrain that we've been driving on so far. So as we approach it, we'll get a real view for the first time of what it's really made of.
All right. We'll be following along with you, Dr. Francis. Thank you for taking time to be with us, and good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. We'll be helpful with that name thing if you ever need us, so let us know. Raymond Francis, an engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, he led the team that deployed the Aegis, the new AI system, to Mars. We're going to take a break. When we come back, what if getting a vaccine was as easy as slapping on a Band-Aid? It could happen, and we'll tell you how if you stay with us. We'll be right back.
There are 4 questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Even though it's thin and fragile, your skin does a pretty good job at protecting you from unwanted infection. After all, it is your body's biggest organ. And that protective barrier is why you can't just rub a vaccine onto your skin like a lotion. It needs to get to the other side of the skin. And normally the way to do that is that big old hypodermic needle. Well, what if that cross-skin transport could be done more, how shall we say, subtly? Writing this week in the journal The Lancet, a group of researchers at Emory and Georgia Tech described their initial trials of delivering a flu vaccine via a patch, something like a Band-Aid studded with about 100 microneedles. Joining me now to talk about that effort and the advantages it could offer is Mark Prausnitz, Regents Professor in the Department of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering, also Director of the Center for Drug Design, Development, and Delivery at Georgia Tech, and he is one of the investigators. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Give me a radio view of the patch. What does it look like?
What it looks like to the eye is something, as you said, like a Band-Aid. It's about an inch across, has a little tab on it for you to grab onto, so you can press it to the skin, push down, and then leave it in place for a few minutes. Now, if you zoomed in microscopically, you would see that there are 100 conically shaped microneedles that are a few hundred microns tall that have penetrated into the skin and are dissolving in the skin, releasing encapsulated vaccine.
And so what does it feel like when it's applied?
You feel a little something. You're aware of the pressure of your thumb pushing. And some people describe it like feeling maybe there's some Velcro on the skin, but people don't describe it as painful.
And so what happens to the needles after they go into your skin?
Well, a key feature that we've designed into it is that the needles are water-soluble, so they simply disappear. After you remove the patch, there's nothing sharp left on it. It can't be reused, and it doesn't pose any more danger than a used Band-Aid.
Wow. And could you put this patch, people put it on themselves, or do you have to have a doc or nurse do it?
The objective is that people do it themselves. So in the clinical trial that we just recently completed, one group of people received the flu vaccine patch administered by a nurse, but another group of people did it themselves, and they did it just as well as the trained nurse did.
Is the active agent here any different from the regular flu vaccine? Is it the same stuff?
It is, exactly. So it is one of the commercially available flu vaccines. We reformulated it into a microneedle patch. And in fact, one of the other groups in the clinical trial was the conventional injected flu vaccine.
Now, we always worry about transporting drugs. You know, they go through the mail, or they heat destroys them. Is there a problem if, let's say, if you wanted to mail this out to your patients? Would it survive that delivery?
Well, that's another thing that we considered in the design of the patch, was to make it as stable as possible. So we have shown that the patch is stable without refrigeration. We've gone out to 1 year now at 40 degrees Celsius, and the vaccine is still fully potent. So as a result, you don't need an ice pack, for example. You could just put your patch in a small padded envelope.
So this is you're describing a phase one trial, so you haven't looked at how effective it is, but you must have some initial findings.
Sure. This study was, as you're indicating, study was designed primarily to look at safety as a first time in humans, but we did measure the immune response in after giving the vaccine in the various different methods. And what we found is that vaccination with this microneedle patch was just as good as vaccination by the conventional injection by a few different measures of the immune response. Mm-hmm.
And you've already created a company working to commercialize this.
There is a company called Micron Biomedical, which is licensing the technology from Georgia Tech and is in the process of working not only to commercialize a flu vaccine patch, but delivering other vaccines and drugs using this technology.
Now, I would imagine that there's got to be pushback from the healthcare industry about a vaccine that doesn't require a doctor's office visit for which they could charge.
Well, there is some pushback. The pushback I've heard hasn't primarily been a financial one, but it's been one of just general concern that vaccines are given in a healthcare setting, and it's just unusual for a vaccine to be taken out of it. But at the same time, if we think of the various drugs we can buy over the counter and how many of them can actually be quite dangerous if used inappropriately, and compare that to a flu vaccine, the flu vaccine is just so much safer.
You know, yes, you're talking about a flu vaccine. And of course, when we talk about vaccines, we think about the giant universe of vaccination, which, of course, is leading me to the question of, could you generalize this to other vaccines? Can you make other kinds that would work like a patch like this?
Yes. So the flu vaccine is the one that has advanced the furthest. But coming up behind it is work on a polio vaccine patch, as well as a measles and rubella vaccine patch. This is work we're doing in collaboration with the World Health Organization and the Gates Foundation. And the idea here is not so much that people can self-administer it, which we'd like for flu vaccine, but that it could be given in mass vaccination campaigns by minimally trained personnel going house to house.
And so how close are you to actually getting one that's gone through all the testing and is ready to be distributed?
Well, the one that's furthest along is the flu vaccine, and that is that we hope is going to be available for patients to use within 5 years.
That's pretty soon. And as you say, this would be the ideal thing to be able to distribute around the world.
Yes, yeah, so we think of it not only in the U.S. context, but there are even more stringent constraints, let's say, in developing countries, which while the opportunity for, say, money to pay for advances is less, the constraints in many ways are even harder.
I'll bet. Thank you, Dr. Prosnitz, for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Mark Prosnitz is a researcher at Georgia Tech. And now a topic close to my heart, my stomach. Earlier this hour, I suggested that you might want to get some dark chocolate handy. Don't you love it when we talk to stuff with dark chocolate? Because it's something we always like to say you can do this at home, because we're going to do a little experiment a bit later. So go on and get whichever kind of dark chocolate that you like. But first, think of the last time you ate airplane food. Did you enjoy that experience, or was it, you know, airplane food, not exactly known for deliciousness? The fault for that, according to my next guest, may not actually lie with bad cooking or bland ingredients. Instead, he says, it's the din, the noise of the engines, the lack of cabin pressure. These things could be ruining our taste buds, and therefore that airplane meal ruined as well. Charles Spence is a self-described gastrophysicist. That is a nice gastronomy pun there, and he studies the environmental cues and sensory inputs that help us enjoy our food. And in his latest book, he describes a whole bunch of things we're learning about, how to get more out of our home cooking, our restaurant meals, and even, yes, hospital food. And it could be as simple as changing the color of a plate or keeping the music slower. We're going to talk about all of these things. And if you have your own ideas, our number, 844-724-8255. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry, 844-724-8255. Charles Spence is a professor of experimental psychology at University of Oxford, and author of a new book, Gastrophysics, the New Science of Food. And he joins us from Oxford, England. Thank you for staying up late for us, Dr. Spruce.
It's a pleasure.
Let's talk about food, and why gastrophysics? How did you come up with that name?
It's a kind of scientific-sounding term indeed, but it's there to kind of capture our interest in studying gastronomy, kind of nice food experiences, the things that we look forward to and enjoy and share and talk about. And on the other hand, the kind of physics is from psychophysics, which is kind of a branch of psychology where you try and systematically study the factors that affect human perception and behavior.
Let's start with what I was talking about, airplane food. How could something in our ears, like loud engine noise, affect what we're actually tasting with our tongues?
Well, the evidence collected over the last couple of years shows that those loud sounds of the engine, together with the lowered cabin pressure and the dry air, together mean that food doesn't taste the same as it does on the ground. No news to anyone. But what is the new finding is that that loud engine noise seems to suppress our ability to taste sweet and salt in food, but actually enhances our ability to taste that mysterious fifth taste of umami, what we find in tomatoes, mushrooms, anchovies, and so on, Parmesan cheese. I think it sort of explains why it is that so many people, maybe a quarter of all airline passengers, will order a tomato juice or a Bloody Mary in the air and never touch the stuff when they're down on the ground. It's almost as if we're sort of self-medicating for the one drink whose flavor, if anything, improves in the air relative to other things that we might consume.
That answers the question of why they even stock it on an airplane.
The best seller.
That's very interesting. We're going to do a little experiment of our own. And earlier in the hour, I suggested to our listeners to get some dark chocolate handy. And that's because you've been investigating using music to season our food. How does that work?
Well, that's kind of the flip side of the bad noise of the engines and overly loud restaurants suppressing our taste buds. We're more interested in a way in trying to figure out how we can use sound, music, soundscapes positively as a kind of sonic seasoning. Sounds bizarre, but from research we've been doing over the last decade, we find that you can systematically modulate people's experience of a food or a drink simply by changing the kind of the sound qualities of the music that's playing in the background.
Okay, here's what I'm going to do. Just for science, I have to eat some chocolate a few times. Somebody's got to do it. I'm going to eat some chocolate. Then I'm going to listen to a few different music clips to make it more specific. I don't know what they are, so we'll decide. We'll see. You'll surprise me. So here we're going to take one bite of the chocolate without the music first for control.
Mm. Okay. There we go. And then we have two 30-second music clips. We're going to play the clip, sip some water between, and know whether the chocolate tastes more bitter or sweet. I'm going to do that for the second clip. But Charles, Charles Berquist, our director, let's play the first clip. All right, let me take a sip of water now. Clear the palate. Take another bite and hear the second piece. Okay. I noticed immediately, the sound was so powerful on the second one, I could hardly enjoy the chocolate I was eating. Is that right? Did I get that right?
That's right. So those two soundscapes have been based on the research from the lab in Oxford and from restaurants and bars around the world. And one of them, most people will say, sounded sweeter than the other. The question is, was the first sound sweet or was the second sound the sweeter of the two?
I would say the first sound was the sweeter of the two.
So those sort of more tinkling, more high-pitched sounds, most people will associate with sweet taste, whereas the second one was much lower in pitch, kind of rougher sound, and those low-pitched sounds tend to be associated with bitterness. Hmm. So most people will make those associations just spontaneously. Kind of curious when you say that sweet and bitter don't literally have a sound, and yet we all associate a sound with them. And then when you take something like a bittersweet dark chocolate or a slightly sweetened black coffee and play those tracks, they can kind of almost draw your attention to the sweetness in your mouth or to the bitterness, and by so doing, it kind of makes it a little bit more salient or intense to you. Just in much the same way that when you're in a wine tasting, say, and the expert says, can you get the asparagus? And suddenly you can. It's there. It's been there all along, but you couldn't quite pick it up. And the same thing you can do more subtly with these almost synesthetic kind of soundscapes.
We also have a clip of a sour sound. Let's play that one. Wow, that is sour.
so that is the sourest music known to mankind. It comes from Bruno Mez, a colleague down in Argentina, who's kind of mathematically transformed Argentinian tango. Though you wouldn't know it from what comes out. And that you can guarantee, if you have something with a bit of sourness in it, say a white wine, then it will kind of really bring out the sourness. Perhaps not necessarily a great tasting experience, but a very different tasting experience than the one you would have without music or while listening to something else.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with Charles Spence, an experimental psychologist from the University of Oxford, author of Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating. It's really a very interesting book, and we're delving into it. If restaurants understand what you're saying, might they start offering some headphones or something? People who are eating.
They do already. As some of the airlines do. Sometimes just more sort of, short-term demonstrations or interventions or marketing-led things. But I think there is a real potential here to put the headphones on or to play it over the loudspeakers, a track to change the taste. And really this kind of, these soundscapes really came out of a work we did a decade ago with the chef Heston Blumenthal, when we did an experiment here in Oxford, giving people oysters, playing the sounds of the sea, giving them oysters and playing the sounds of farmyard chickens or something else, and it really changed the tasting experience for them, and that led to the sound of the sea, the signature dish, seafood dish at the Fat Duck restaurant, where in fact it comes to the table looking like the sea, and the waiter will bring a conch shell out of which dribble some earbuds. He'll recommend that you put them in, and when you do so, you'll hear the sounds of the waves, the seagulls overhead, you'll be more mindful of what you're eating, and it will hopefully enhance the taste of what is already a great dish.
Well, let me, before I go to the break, you brought up an interesting point that I'm trying to get more into, and that is mindfulness when you eat, paying attention to the flavors.
That's right. A lot of the work that's sort of covered in the book kind of hinges on this notion that if you're distracted from what you eat, then your brain doesn't really pick up the cues that you are consuming, and hence those sensory cues, the smells, the tastes, the textures of food, that's what you need to get lots of in order to convince your brain that you're full. So if you're watching the TV, if you're distracted by a mobile device, that can lead to almost a third more food consumed because your attention's elsewhere. And anything you can do to bring people's attention back to the food, to enhance the sensations, the flavors, the tastes and textures, will both make the thing a better tasting experience, a more memorable one, and will also hopefully help nudge people towards consuming slightly less but being no less satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully we can nudge people toward reading your book, Gastrophysics, The New Science of Eating, with Charles Spence, who is our guest this hour. We're gonna take a short break and bring him right back and cover lots of different things about all the other senses, how they're involved, and all your tasting experiences. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Maybe you're getting ready for the holiday weekend. You have some tips to share on tasting stuff. We'll be right back after this break. Sorry. Oh, this is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I'm sorry to be rude. I'm sorry. Eating a potato chip. But there is a method to my madness here, because we are talking about the psychology that makes our food taste better, whether it's a heavy spoon or a round wine glass, with my guest, experimental psychologist Charles Spence, author of Gastrophysics, The New Science of Food. And the reason I was eating these potato chips, or I guess as you call them, crisps across the pond there.
That's right.
Is that the sound, you write about how important sound is in our eating habits.
That's right. It's kind of one of the mysteries, really, that it makes sense why we like sweetness, given it sort of signals the stuff we need for growth, and why we might dislike bitterness, because that might be bad for us. But why do so many of the foods that we crave, that we love, that we snack on, involve a sonic element of crunch, crisp, crackle, squeaky, even creamy and carbonated? They all have a kind of certain sonic signature. That's kind of summed up, really, in the sort of question of why it is that none of us out there at all would like the taste of a soggy potato chip. I think it's got the nutrition, it's got everything there, it's got the taste, the colour, all it's missing is the sound, and yet that is deeply unappealing thought to anyone. So there's something about sound that's really intrinsically sort of rewarding, I think, and the question is to try and figure out what is it that signals in food that might draw us to it.
Mm-hmm. Your work looks at all the five senses, though it turns out that colour and even the shape of the dishes matter.
That's right. While you cannot literally taste the glass or taste the plate or bowl, nevertheless, I think the colour, the shape, the texture, the feel, the weight of the plateware, crockery, cutlery, all do exert an impact on what we think about what we're tasting, how much we enjoy it, how satisfying or satiating we think it might be. So, for example, in one of our first studies in the area, we were working with a Ferran Adrià from the Alicia Foundation in Spain, one of the world's top chefs with his research center. And there we had people coming in and tasting a pinkish red strawberry mousse. And they first tasted it off the white plate and then off a black plate, or vice versa. And we asked them, how sweet does it taste? How flavorful? How much do you like that strawberry mousse? And kind of the amazing result to come out then, which has been replicated many times since, is that the dessert tasted 7% sweeter to people when they were tasting it from a white plate, 9% more liked and 13% more flavorful than exactly the same mousse in exactly the same people, but from the black plate instead.
Wow. Wow. And I imagine that the size and shape of the plate influences your vision of what you're eating, I mean, and even how much you're eating.
Yeah, so there's a large body of research out there suggesting that one of the ways to help nudge ourselves and those we feed towards eating a little less, maybe to serve food off a smaller plate from a smaller bowl or from a rimless bowl, because all of those little tricks will make it appear to our brains based on sort of visual illusions, like there's more food there, and that might help us to eat a little less. And we see it even now in the Far East. There are a number of sort of virtual reality, augmented reality headsets coming onto the market that will actually make the food you're eating look bigger than it really is. So if you see a really big cookie, but in fact it's only actually small, will your brain be as full as it would have been from the big cookie or not? And that's kind of the where the research is going now, these sort of sensory nudges through all of the senses that can be used hopefully to help us move towards where we want to be in terms of consumption.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Sacramento, California. Martha, welcome to Science Friday. Hi, Martha.
Hi, this is Martha.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'm curious why restaurants these days are always so noisy. Mm-hmm. All the hard surfaces, the open kitchen, the music, even television overhead, makes conversation hard, and I really don't even want to go to a restaurant anymore.
Yes, I know what you mean. I think part of the answer is down to kind of the new sort of fashion for that sort of Nordic feel with it, when all the tablecloths, the cushions, the curtains, the carpets all been stripped out down to the bare wood, the stone, the hard reflective surfaces that make whatever noise is there sound that much louder to us. But it's also, I think, partly this kind of shift that's sort of come, I think, originally from sort of New York chefs who very often would listen to loud rock music in the kitchen to help motivate them to chop and dice all day long. And they thought, well, if we're listening to that music in the kitchen, well, maybe our diners would like to listen to it out there in the front of house, and that led to some overly loud tracks being played in restaurants, and that kind of pattern, I think, has now been moving out around the world, such that many a restaurant critic now will actually not only rate the quality of the food, but have a little sound level on there to say, I couldn't hear myself speak, or it's a nice kind of quiet, comfortable listening level. So I think it really is a problem when we see some of those restaurants, especially in New York, but coming in at over 100 decibels of background noise. That is so loud, it's definitely going to be suppressing your ability to taste the food. But beyond that, it's probably causing long-term hearing damage to anyone who's spending a great deal of time working there.
Speaking of noises, I've got a few tweets in. This is Representative. Please, please, Ira, I love your show, but do not eat on the air. It's crude beyond belief. Don't do that again. Someone else says, I apologize.
You should be careful because, you know, this phenomenon of misophonia, these people who get so irritated by the sound of other people chewing gum, puckering their lips or biting into crisps. And in the book, there are a couple of examples where people have been shot because they made food while eating popcorn and other things in cinemas in the US and in Europe too.
So there's actually a word for it now.
Yes, misophonia. It seems primarily related to sort of food-related sounds driving people to distraction. And just last year, colleagues in the UK looked at sort of the neural underpinnings of this and could show significant differences in brain activity in those who complained of this kind of this condition.
Hmm. Well, I apologize to everybody I have offended, but food was good. Here's a question for you in the age of social media. Why are people driven to share a photo of what they're eating? What is behind? I have to just take a picture and tweet it out or Facebook or something.
That's right. I think there are more and more people who are doing that these days. From a recent survey here in the UK, it's 40% of diners, when they go out to eat or to drink, cannot help but take pictures and share them of the food and drinks. And I speak to chefs and to cocktail makers last week, and they were saying, you know, it's bizarre. People are now coming into our bars and they're saying, I want this. And what they mean by this is sort of showing a picture on their smartphone that somebody has sent them. And the barman will say, you know, do you know you like that? Do you know what it is? Do you know what it's called? Do you know how much it costs? And they have no idea about any of these things, but they've seen it. It's kind of what you might call gastro porn, food porn, and they want it. So it's a really growing trend. And I think as a chef or a restaurateur or a barista and beyond, you have to sort of play into that. There are a few who will say, no, I'm really annoyed with this trend. In my restaurant, you cannot use your mobile devices. That'll last a week or two, but then you have to relent, especially given how much kind of free media coverage those sort of sharing of images can result in. And for us, we then try and help some of the chefs and say, look, you know, look how widely your signature dish has been shared around the world. People like Albert Landgraf has this wonderful, like, purple onions and a green foam dish, and it's his signature dish. And we ask him, you know, people all over the world are seeing this. thinking about eating it, how did you decide how to plate it? Because it's a really important image. And he'll say, I did care about it. I did think about it, but it was just kind of intuitive. And that's where the gastrophysics comes in to say, okay, from what we know about vision and people's perception of the visual arts and painting, this is what we think will look good in terms of plating. And we'll take the chef's dishes, put them online, and ask people around the world, if you were going to Albert's restaurant tonight, would you like your plate like this or like that? Or what we kind of always do, you know, sometimes when you go to a restaurant, that the waiter will put the dish down in front of you, and you just kind of tilt it a little bit, just twist it a few degrees. It won't change the taste, but it may change the visual appearance in ways that, to the extent that we do eat first with our eyes, can make things taste better. But the danger in the long run, I think, has to be that if people spend too much time thinking, how will my dish photograph, they may one day start to forget about what it tastes like, and that we wouldn't really want to be there.
Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Sean. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question was about the companies that traffic in different sizes and shapes of wine glasses as highlighting or focusing the flavors or aromas of a particular kind of wine. Mm-hmm. Is this something that we've found to be objectively true, or is it more just very active imaginative marketing?
It's a bit of both. I absolutely believe that serving wine or other drinks, beers or coffees or soft drinks from different shaped and sized receptacles does make a difference to the experience. But I think not for the reason that those who are very often promoting glassware will have you believe. Because what you see from the lab is that if you blindfold people so they can't see the glass, if you put the glass under their nose and just agitate it on a machine so all the aromas come off, but say they can't see the glass, they can't feel it, then there's no difference between different glass shapes. But we normally drink with our eyes open, holding the glass in our hands, and as soon as you do that, then wines can taste dramatically different as a function of the glass shape. And so in some of our research just published this week, we did it with a beer in Australia and found that if you take drink the same beer from a straight-sided glass versus one that's kind of curved from bottom to top, then it will taste fruitier in the curved-sided glass. And that's exactly the same result that's been found previously for wine. Round-shaped wine glasses will bring out fruitiness. More angular-shaped glasses will bring out sourness, acidity, and in fruit juices too. And I think this is all about what's going on in the mind of the person holding and seeing the glass, the expectations that are set therein, and not about the different flow properties of the liquids on your tongue or the capture of different volatiles above the drink.
In fact, we asked listeners on Twitter how they preferred their beer, and the answer was almost unanimous. They like drinking it from a glass, and that was followed by a bottle and then a can.
That's right. And you want to say, why does it, for so many of us, seem to taste better, whether it's beer or a soft drink, from a bottle rather than a can? And that's a question that many people intuitively think there's a difference there, but no one has ever experimentally tested it. So at the Edinburgh Science Festival last year, we had 300 people come through, and they got to drink a beer that they saw had been poured from a bottle or from a can. Exactly the same batch of beer, and yet those who'd rated the beer from the bottle did indeed say it tasted better. And I think that's down in a way to the extra weight that a bottle has relative to most cans. And it's that weight in the hand or in cutlery or in plateware or in packaging that does lead to better taste experiences.
If you're just joining us, so we're talking with the author Charles Spence, professor of psychology at Oxford. His new book, Gastrophysics, the New Science of Food, and you can read an excerpt of his book on our webpage at sciencefriday.com/flavor. Let's talk about the presentation a little bit. You mentioned how important that was before. Does the cutlery have anything to do with
our— It does. And I think that's going to be a real kind of a radical area for transformation in the next few years. Because if you think about it, some of those top chefs are doing amazing things. They're no longer just constrained by the round white American plate. They're plating on slate and bricks and in flower pots. Well, some of them are, at least. So there's been a lot more innovation in plating and in plateware. But when you think about cutlery, the knives and the forks and the spoons, that has not changed for a century. And it's so boring. And it's like, cold, hard, smooth, stainless steel and silver. That's it. Knife, fork and spoon, that's it. Go back a century, Victorian cutlery sets might have had 100 different items, things that we today cannot even figure out quite what they're there for. What on earth would you use them for? But that's all about to change, and I see it changing in two ways. Firstly, more and more of the top restaurants are starting to serve a number of the dishes as finger food. Forgetting about cutlery altogether, take Mugaritz in San Sebastian, 2 Michelin-starred restaurant, and this Spanish restaurant has got rid of cutlery altogether. 25 courses or so, all to be eaten with the hands. It's kind of a challenge for the chefs. How do you serve food that works that way? There are a lot of wet towels going around. But still, I think it's them questioning, why do we do it this way, and could we do it better? And on the flip side, I see people working with textured handle spoons, textured kind of the spoon of the spoon, as it were. And if you were to go to the Fat Duck restaurant, one of the world's top ones in Bray in the UK from Heston Blumenthal, the last course comes to the table. It's a miraculous dish. It's floating in midair. But the thing that's most amazing to me is the spoon that it is served with. And based on the research from our lab, when you pick that spoon up, you go, wow, that's really, really heavy. Because we know that things that are heavier than you expect tends to connote quality and you enjoy things more. And it's also got a furry handle. You think, what's going on there? Well, again, what you feel in the hand can change your experience of what you put in your mouth.
I got to interrupt. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Sorry, we have to break it. I hate when I have to do that. But a furry handle, did you say?
I did indeed.
What kind of fur is it made out of?
Oh, sort of white, almost.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? Whatever.
And it's scented. It's scented as well. It's a truly multi-sensory implement, and in that way, the future lies.
All right, we've covered the waterfront on this, so let's bring back full circle and talk about what does this mean to the average bloke eating at home. How do we change or make a better experience for ourselves?
So I think a lot of the insights that the kind of come out of this work that's maybe mainly going on at the high end, the Michelin star, the San Pellegrino listed top restaurants, it seems esoteric and not that it wouldn't apply to us unless we were to eat there. But in fact, I think it does percolate down from their top end all the way through to chains, to the air, to hospitals, and then to the home. And how so? Well, for those who are cooking, dining at home, then maybe you have different things in mind. It might be that you want, what tips can I use in order to help me eat a little bit less but not stay hungry? What tips can I have next time I throw a dinner party to create the most memorable evening that any of my guests have ever had? Or just what on earth can I do to get my kids to eat their vegetables? I think for any of those three questions, there are solutions from the book and from the high end. So if you take something like sort of creating a memorable meal, then what you see some of the top chefs doing are giving a sort of tasting menu. So lots of small courses are able to create more sticky memories that might stay around in your guests' minds for longer. Then you might give them a surprise amuse-bouche, because surprises stick in mind more. And then kind of a very idea, well, we'll sit them down and we'll just give them a big main course that's not going to stay in memory. So you want to do theatrical things, memorable things.
But I have to, so many people are just sitting there on their cell phones eating or on their laptops at the same time. They don't care what, you could put anything on that.
Yeah, right. So I know. So I think the number one tip has to be just turn the TV off, whatever you do. That will probably may lead you to eat a third less. That will kind of force you to focus on the food and those you're with. And beyond that, then.
Good advice.
Good
advice. A lot of good advice in the book, Gastrophysics, The New Science of Food by Charles Spence, Professor of Experimental Psychology at Oxford, joining us in the evening time at Oxford. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, and have a good weekend.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt from the book on our website at sciencefriday.com/flavor. I don't know if he's taking any volunteers to taste test his next book, so you might ask him when you write him an email. That's about all the time we have for this program. I want to thank BJ Lederman, who composed our theme music, and our thanks again to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. Have a great and safe holiday weekend. Have a great 4th of July. We'll see you after the holiday next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.